Welcome to episode 129 of the Sports Geek Podcast. This week, I chat with Vine superstar Ian Paget.
Welcome to the Sports Geek Podcast, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals. And now, here's your host, who has skydived and bungee jumped. What's next? Sean Callanan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. Yes, I think my skydiving and bungee jumping days are behind me, but you never know. Always happy to try new experiences. My name is Sean Callanan, and you are listening to the Sports Geek Podcast. You might be doing that on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or my favourite app, Pocket Casts. Let me know. I would love to hear from you on what app you are using to listen to podcasts. Do you listen to it on the website, sportsgeekhq.com? Do you just use iTunes, the podcasting app there, or do you have your own, Downcast, any others? Those kind of things. Send me an email, sean@sportsgeekhq.com, or send me a tweet at Sean Callanan. Wanted to follow up the episode from last week with Scott Kegley from the Minnesota Vikings. If you haven't checked that out, please go to sportsgeekhq.com/128. If you did go to the episode last week and you saw a blank website, I don't know, a blank web page, I don't know what happened with WordPress. It somehow swallowed the post when I hit publish. That has been updated. There's actually a whole bunch of nice links in there, some really good content from Scott and the Vine Kings and the things that he's doing there. So you would have got the episode flowing through to your podcasting app of choice, but yeah, the show notes were empty. So thank you very much for those who pointed that out to me and sent me a message saying what was up with the show notes. They've now been updated. If you go to sportsgeekhq.com/128, you can get to that episode. Before I get into my interview with Ian Paget, let me take this time to mention our sponsor for this episode. Ever having trouble understanding how to connect with your fans? Want to know how to value your content for sponsors? Want to drive more fans into your stadium? Sorry, there isn't an app for that. No app can do that. You need SportsGeek. Simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/help, enter your details, and mention my name, Sean, S-E-A-N. I will give you a call and we'll discuss your sports marketing goals. Simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/help and mention my name, Sean, S-E-A-N. It's as easy as that. Thank you very much to JJ Redick and SeatGeek for providing that copy for that ad. If you listen to other podcasts, hopefully you get and understand the in-joke with the SeatGeek ads. Now, without any more advertisements, here is my chat with Ian Paget on how to use Vine to give your brand and team a fresh look. Very happy following up my chat with Scott Kegley to be talking to Ian Paget, also known as Origiful, if I get that name right. It is a bit of a mouthful. Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honour.
Well, yes, I got Scott Kegley back and started talking to him about 40 Viners and Fine Kings and how he took it from San Francisco to Minnesota, and I wanted to get some tricks and techniques, and he pretty much pointed all questions back to you. So I thought it'd be a good time to have you on the podcast.
Well, that is great. I need to send him his check then. Thank you, Scott, for referring me.
So take us a little bit back to your background. You've been a video producer and an artist originally. YouTube was your platform early on. And then you started moving to Twitter. So sort of give us a bit of a background of how you've got to where you are today.
Yeah, it's kind of been... The background is really I have a degree in art history and French. And so because of those, I never had any actual job opportunities because there's nothing you can do with those degrees. So I've been an artist ever since I graduated from high school. I lived in France for a long time. Was an artist and painter over there, came back, and I would do kind of construction jobs around the Bay Area and then try to do art shows on the side. And eventually in about 2011, I landed a job at Twitter where I was just kind of like a tech support guy. And while I was at Twitter, I was drawing on whiteboards and making funny cartoons, and I got hired to the video team to kind of animate. And from there, I just kind of took off. We did a lot of YouTube stuff. I started doing a lot more animation, a lot of hand animation, stop motion. But it's kind of been, if I can say it, an ass backwards, kind of just falling into making movies. It wasn't what I was trained in, and I'm so happy to be doing it now, but it was a very winding and strange path to get here.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is a strange one because you are there at Twitter, like you said, doing support. They go and buy this crazy little product, Vine, 6 months before it launches, which is really strange in the startup world. Normally it's, hey, that's got a bit of heat and we'll grab it. And they bought it before it launched. What was it like? And so you were in that, behind the scenes, working at Twitter. What are your early memories of both that acquisition and what you were doing in that team and what the plans were for Vine?
Well, Twitter has definitely had a lot of kind of big misses, and there's still a company that seems to be trying to find itself. But I have to say the acquisition of Vine was a pretty brilliant move. They seem to have really, they seem to have seen early on that short form video was going to be big. And, Vine has really taken a back seat recently, which is a bummer, but the idea of short form media is definitely something that's here to stay, whether in Snapchat or other forms, Instagram video. Everybody wants short, bite-sized pieces of video. So it was a wise acquisition on their part. And having been there at the time behind the scenes, it was interesting because we weren't really sure. There was even questions about what it was going to be called. There were some branding issues. And so when it launched, I actually was the person who made the video explaining what Vine was. And unfortunately, there was the original founders of Vine didn't want, it was a YouTube video, and they didn't want a YouTube video explaining what their video platform was. So the video was scrapped, but technically I was the guy who kind of made the video explaining what the platform was. So from day one, I was well-versed in what it could do, what it was meant to do, and I was producing videos to try to show other people and also onboard kind of users or help people who were kind of taking off and get them more visibility. So literally from day one with Vine, I really got the opportunity to be a part of it, to see it up close and experiment with it. So it was kind of, perfect timing, kind of dumb luck on my end. But what was great was that it really matched well with my skill set and my short attention span. So it was a platform that really spoke to me, and I went to town with it, and it kind of, the rest is history.
I sort of mentioned this in the chat that I had with Scott, in that Vine is very similar to Twitter in its limiting characteristics. Twitter, you have to have brevity in your text. You've only got 140 characters, and in Vine you've got that 6 seconds. So it really makes you as a video producer, bring that same brevity to your editing and your storytelling, and that kind of thing. How have you found that as a discipline or as a skill to learn as someone that, may have produced, YouTube videos or other videos that are longer? What skill or what discipline have you learned by producing Vines?
I mean, I think it just condenses and really purifies your content. I mean, like with this podcast right now, if you just let me talk, I'll go on for minutes rambling, and it's a lot of fluff and doesn't mean anything. But if you say, all right, Ian, you have 2 sentences, tell me what you think is the most important, it forces you to work within the confines of a limited space, and you have to think more, you have to condense it, you have to make it better and make it worth it. So I think there's something great as a producer to have a limited space, a short amount of time where you've got to get your message across. And there's also something liberating about that. If you have a 2-minute YouTube video, you're almost looking, how are you going to fill that time? And you create kind of dead content. People will stop watching halfway through. Whereas if you only have 6 seconds or 10 seconds or 15 seconds, you don't have time to screw around. You don't have time to make kind of lightweight content. You have to get to the point, make it engaging and make it good if you want people to watch it and share it. So I think Vine is kind of like a cocktail napkin. It's small and easy. You're not writing a novel. You can just get your idea out there in its purest form, and it's a great way for a creator to kind of produce idea content.
And was there any, I guess when I saw both the acquisition of Vine and then the proposed launch and those kind of things, there was discussion, at least externally, I don't know how much of it happened internally, on whether Twitter, because they acquired Vine before it launched, whether it would be launched effectively just as the video platform that is going to be embedded into Twitter, or its own product. They obviously went through with the separate platform, and now Vines are effectively embedded in tweets when you're seeing them through this stream. How important do you think that was for the whole Vine infrastructure and the Vine community that Vine was its own platform?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I, you know, you have hindsight, you have what ifs, you have regrets. There's a part of me that wonders if there won't be a future iteration where things will become more central. I understand the logic as to why they did an external app. They wanted it to be its own product. There was no need for it to live within the Twitter app, since Twitter in and of itself, even though it's only 140 characters, it's still a complicated product to navigate and understand. I mean, you only need to see politicians having DM fails to understand that mistakes can be made. So adding a video layer to that could have been tough, but at the same time, we've seen recently with Periscope, Periscope is now embedded within the Twitter app. You can access and post to it from Twitter. So there may be more that comes out with Vine that way. I don't know. To think about, I don't, should they have done it differently? Maybe. It's unfortunate to see now that I think that Vine definitely has taken a, it's definitely slowed down, and you've seen Snapchat just skyrocket and everything. But, you know, I think a lot of that was because the founders of Vine had a vision and they wanted to stay true to it. They didn't want to be kind of taken over and go in the wrong direction. So, you know, there's something to be said about sticking to your guns. But I think there's also room to kind of make a comeback and rethink some of the choices that have been made with Vine. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, you know, the next year to 2 years here, especially as Twitter probably goes through some big changes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for mine, you know, I was initially thinking, oh, Twitter needs video. Here's this video platform. I just thought it was a late amateur that it was going to be embedded in the product, and I was a little bit confused when it did, you know, did create its own thing. But then it became, because it became its own community, and you started getting really high end content and people specifically building for that content. There became people who, one, went to Vine to watch those videos, whether they be you know, storytelling videos, or in, you know, in the NBA world, highlights packages and the like, that started getting shared on that. So it became its own ecosystem. I do think it has a few more pivots in it on how it gets integrated into both Twitter and the larger I guess mainstream of how it fits in that space. But the whole idea of, we want it instantly, we don't want to watch a 3-minute video, that's where Vine's sweet spot is.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's also, it's a difficult subject, because at the same time, it's like Vine is so seamlessly integrated into Twitter that I, you know, I can watch 30 Vines while I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed, and actually I haven't even logged into Vine that day. So I'm still experiencing Vine in a big way, even though I'm not on the app. So it's kind of like, I think there's a lot of kind of smoothing that can be put, a little oil under those gears to make it a little more fluid and coherent, just because right now there's kind of this strangeness of the fact that Vine, I think, still as a video format is brilliant, but I think that there is some question about, like, how do you get it where Vine as a platform makes sense as a separate entity? So I don't know. I've been out of Twitter now for 3 years, so I no longer have any of my insider viewpoints, but it is fascinating to kind of think about still just the amount of potential that's there and what can be done, and kind of waiting to see what happens.
And it is always different from a video platform. If you look at YouTube, Snapchat, and those and Vine and those things, is how many people produce it versus how many people watch it. I mean, the stats from Twitter are things like 40% of people don't tweet; they're just consuming tweets. I'm assuming that's far higher on the Vine side, where I'm a consumer of Vines. I don't produce a lot of Vines myself, but I watch them either through the app or through Twitter. And it really becomes, you know, a battle of the platform for the top producers and making sure that they're producing content that keeps driving people to watch it. So that's always the battle when you're producing a platform that is all about content. You need people to keep feeding that machine and putting more content in.
Yeah, and it's tough too, especially when it's just, I mean, the Silicon Valley world is in such competition. I mean, as with any sort of sport, every year has a new reigning champ, and that is always taken down the next year. So on the one hand, it's dicey, because you've got everybody who wants to dethrone you and replace you. And on the other hand, I think it's good for competition and good for development, because it forces every brand to not just sit on its laurels and soak in the sun. So things are constantly changing, but it's a vicious dog-eat-dog world of innovation.
Speaking more of the content than the platform, like you were at Twitter and you were producing a bunch of the Vines in promoting Twitter and promoting some of their their content partners. You did a really early one during the NBA Finals for the Spurs, Spurs Heat in stats with, you know, claymation style. And then started doing the stuff with Scott at the 40 Viners when you left Twitter to start your own business with Origiful. I'm going to keep stuffing up that name, and I'm going to get you to give me the reasons why. But take us through that leap of faith, leaving Twitter, and because you were seeing that interest from brands both in sport but outside of sport on producing this content that can engage an audience.
First off, I'm amazed at the amount of homework you did. That's impressive. I don't know even how you found the fact that I did that Spurs like infographic, but we were having a huge amount of success about just some of our YouTube kind of funnier, more viral video type stuff on YouTube. And then with Vine, it was just an easier way for us to produce content really quick. And what happened was, I think that I had gotten to the point as a video producer that I was frustrated with spending months working on a 2-minute long YouTube video. And for me, Vine was a breath of fresh air where I could just produce something in an afternoon and it was done. And the way that my personal trajectory went was that I started every morning before I would go to Twitter to work, I would make a Vine in my living room. I'd wake up like a half hour earlier and I gave myself an artistic challenge to just produce something. And for me, it was kind of like a creative cup of coffee where I could just produce it, get it off my plate, and then by the time I showed up for work, my brain was always already thinking creatively and I was ready to go for these other projects. But as a result of that, the fact that I was producing this very consistent daily content stream, my personal account just kind of blew up. And so after, I think it must have been probably about 6 months to a year after Vine came out, I had amassed, I think already at that time, like 200,000 followers, and I was getting offers from brands right and left to produce content for them. And just some really amazing opportunities, everything from doing music videos to going to the Olympics to doing stuff for brands that I'd always admired and wanted to work with. And unfortunately, the conflict of interest there just wasn't something I could work out because I knew that if I was producing Vines for, you know, the 49ers and then they were promoting it on Twitter as content and I worked at Twitter, it was kind of like a vicious snake eating its own tail where there was just too much of a conflict. So I had to make the choice. I still to this day miss Twitter. I have so many friends from there. I love the company. I love the message of the company and what they're trying to do. But it was one of those things that looking back, like had I not gone off and tried to start my own company and do this, I would have totally regretted it. So I've been thrilled. I've had so many cool opportunities to do everything from go to the Met Gala and hang out with, you know, people like David Beckham to, you know, work with someone like Scott Cagley. And Scott Cagley is probably one of the most just solid quality, positive people I've ever worked with. And it's been super cool these, you know, I guess going on 3 years now of creating content with him. So hell of a ride, but it's been super cool. And all of that really just to thanks to this silly little video platform. So very, very fortunate.
So I tried to get into with Scott on how he approaches it. And it's obviously you've got a really good rapport and backwards and forwards with Scott on what the brief is, what he's looking for. But really, he does give you the creative scope to say, here's the game coming up. And he pretty much said, I just wait to find out what Ian sends me through because I really look forward to it. Is that a common brief? Do you get some that are a little bit tighter than that? Or do they just say, Ian, here's what we've got. Do your magic and come back to our stuff. What's some of that push and pull?
It's a great question, and I think that what Scott and I have found is actually a what I think would be as close to an ideal marriage of producer and client that you could find, especially in this world of kind of influencer marketing or people doing what I do, where they're hired by brands to kind of use their style to create stuff. To explain it, between Scott and I, I was actually really worried about this interview because the fact is I know almost nothing about sports. I'm probably the least athletic person you could ever meet, and my knowledge of sports is pretty much zero, which you would think would be horrible. And if I were a marketing firm, you would never get hired by, you know, the 49ers or the Vikings. But it actually works perfectly with Scott and I because when a team hires someone like me, oftentimes what I'm bringing to the table is something fresh and different. And the fact that I am a sports outsider means that I'm not going to be producing the same sort of content that fans of the team are already seeing on any sort of channel or platform that they're using to follow the sports teams they like. So with Scott and I, Scott is the sports genius. He's a marketing genius behind how he wants to run the platforms for the teams he's working with. And for me, he'll help me understand the basics of, what's important in the sports world. But then he really lets me bring my own style, my own creativity to it. And it's so fortunate to work with someone like him, where he really doesn't tell me what to do. He gives me his full trust. And that, as a creator, gives me free rein to really kind of just do what I think I do best, create crazy and weird stuff that nobody else is doing that he can then plug into his channels. And it offers something fresh, something vibrant, something different, that doesn't always work, but it's better than just the same old. So I think it's a really good compliment. We complement each other really well in terms of he's running the bigger picture and I'm kind of a fun, really interesting, unique addition to what he's doing that spices it up. And unfortunately, that's the biggest fail that you see with a lot of teams, is where they'll bring in someone like me and then they want to tell them exactly what to do, which if you're going to do that, you might as well just do it yourself or just hire a marketing agency to produce your content. If you're going to hire someone who, like myself, has kind of made a name for himself or has his own style and is known for that, it's better to bring them in and say, like, all right, here's what we're working with. Now do your thing with it. And I think that's where you get kind of the best marriage of originality and content. It makes for good, engaging stuff.
Yeah, I think that's. I think there's a couple of points there. I think definitely if you're going to hire a creative as opposed to, like you sort of said, an executioner, if you're going to hire a creative, let them. That's why you've hired them. Let them be creative and give them the broad scope. You can give them the high points of this is a big rival or this game means a lot or this is a really passionate point for our fans. But that's pretty much, here's the brushes. We're not going to tell you exactly how to draw the masterpiece, so to speak. So I think that's really, really important. And I think the other piece is, and I like it a lot, looking at other industries, whether they be entertainment, the arts, music, that kind of thing, to see what is happening outside of the world of sports, because then you do get that fresh feel, because we all do as practitioners in the industry. We see what all the other teams are doing. And yes, I love the phrase steal with pride. You can always take something else and put your own brand and your own team twist on it. But if you go completely outside your field, it's going to be fresh and engaging and stand out. And I think that was one of the key takeaways that Scott said for all the stuff that you're doing is it's deliberately different. It jars is probably the wrong word, but it jars in their feed because it stops their feed and then they watch it, so it gets that result. And if you're going to be very prescriptive to your creative to say, oh, we saw what you did, we want exactly that and change that to be our logo, then you're right, that's not a brief that, one, you'll take on board, and it's not the best use of your abilities.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think that, and then what's been cool too about the exchange I've had with Scott is when we were working at the 49ers, I was going to all the games and he and I were hanging out, and I actually taught Scott, and it's amazing. He films so many of those vines himself now. So a lot of the stuff where you'll see his hand holding a helmet and the helmet spins, or he'll do like a 360 of the stadium. Those were things that part of my original first year contract with him was producing content. And part of it was actually teaching him how to do it himself. So it was a little bit of a risk for me in terms of job security, but luckily, I had other stuff to bring to the table. And what it means is that it also enabled Scott now to be producing really quality content in-house, which I think is, in my predictions of what I think will happen with social video in the years to come, is I think there's going to be more and more of a movement to bring people like me in-house. And Scott's already there because he can do it himself, a lot of the stuff. But I think one of the trends that we're going to see are teams or companies hiring people like me or training people like Scott who are already there to be able to be people who are kind of that next level, where they are totally in tune with what the brand needs and wants, but they're also able to produce this content themselves. So in-house content creators who are kind of on that next level, I think, is going to be a trend. In the same way that maybe 5 or 6 years ago, the idea of having a social media manager was kind of like a perk that certain companies had, and now no company in the world can exist without having like someone who's, a 4-person team in charge of all their social channels. I think we're going to see a trend as well, where we're going to see teams, brands, companies having in-house creative content producers for their social channels, people like me who are actually doing unique stuff that will hopefully become more and more in tune with the brand. So you're not totally an outsider like me, but you're also bringing something fresh. So it'll be interesting to see if that plays out, but that's where I think it's going.
No, I definitely do think that you're right. I mean, early on it was, yes, we need a social media coordinator. Then you're now developing, you know, people that are very good on Twitter and, you know, things like NBA Twitter and things like that on how to respond to fans, how to have that banter, how to set that tone when a good GIF is there. So I think that's already happening on, you know, platforms, especially like Twitter. And I do think, yeah, those roles, whether they be, you know, someone that's directly producing Vine, you're already seeing roles like Snapchat producer and being able to, you know, put together a story on Snapchat. I think those roles are starting to come about. All those roles are evolving, and people are building out that skill set to really raise the bar for everyone else. And then it's a matter of, oh well, those five teams are all doing a really good job on that platform. How do we do it? And you end up having a resource that's required in that space.
And you're totally right. You do see it with the NBA, and other very large entities, and like the one also for me that's kind of a leader is like BuzzFeed now. BuzzFeed has an internal production staff that's insane. They're producing, like with the elections, with the debates, they're producing almost instantaneous content in-house from people who are full-time employees there to do stuff. And you can just see they have such a leg up on everyone around them in terms of the social space that I think it is just a matter of time. It'll no longer be Timmy the intern who's handling the account. It'll be, you know, four or five paid positions in-house that are just cranking out content. So,
And it is a matter of shaping that content for that specific platform, and I think that's where the landscape has shifted. In the, you know, the last 5 years, it was you produce your content here and you put it out on all these platforms. But now I think people are being more and more bespoke on each platform, making sure it's leaning into its both its audience that's on that platform, but then also the features and the tricks that you can do on each platform.
That's especially so true for something like Snapchat, where it's just like being one of the first entities to do whatever kind of creative thing with whatever face overlay is, or, you know, that's just so huge now, having that timely response. So, yeah.
So some of those tips, and I'll share some of your how-to vines in the show notes for this podcast. But what are some of the tips or tricks, or, you know, when someone says, "Hey, Ian, how do I create a great Vine?" What are some of the things that you go to first to say, you know, here's a technique that works really well. Here's how you do this kind of thing. What are some of those tricks that people can, like you said before, get up an hour early, get their creative cup of coffee, and start testing out these tricks?
Yeah, I mean unfortunately the answers I have are maybe less specific than people would want, but the number one is, yes, get up and be producing regular content. It's kind of like working out. If you want to get in shape and be able to beat your personal best, it's not a matter of just like, all right, what's the one exercise I can do this one time that'll make me buff? It's more like, no, go to the gym every day, and after 2 months, you're going to realize you've already made huge improvements. So with any of these platforms, on your own channels or on dummy accounts that you've created, constantly just using the features, producing vines, producing snaps, doing other stuff, like that is crucial to advancing your game and getting in shape. And then the other thing is just, you know, I see content being produced by certain teams or certain companies, and the content isn't bad. It's just there's the things that actually really raise the bar are just the most basic stuff, like making sure that you have like a good iPhone that has a good camera, that you didn't just take your phone out of your pocket and there's a little bit of lint on the screen, like having a clean capture, dimming the background noise if you can so you don't have a lot of weird stuff. But a lot of what makes good social viral content is actually just putting the most minimal effort into it. And then afterwards, you know, there's stuff like how do you do a good big hyperlapse of a building or something, and that gets a little more complicated. But it can be simplified by just having a good tripod to hold your phone. But one of the things that's changed so much since Vine early came out was now no longer you have to produce the content on your phone. Now you can go out and shoot with a high quality DSLR, edit it in After Effects and Premiere, or, you know, Final Cut, and then upload it to Vine. So the quality certainly is something that can be managed better now. But I think in the end, as you've already said, one of the best things you can do is just be constantly using the platforms to experiment and kind of know the ropes.
And is
Sorry, Tom, was that a horrible answer?
No, that's a fine answer. I mean, is there a little bit of the vine?
Like you already answered the question, and I just repeated you.
Yeah, no, that is fine, and that's my fault for answering the question when in my question. Is there a part of the vine community that misses the rigor that was? Oh, you have to create the whole video inside the app.
I definitely do. I think that part of the reasons that I had some success early on was because there were few people who had the patience and the ego-driven desire to do something original, to spend the time to make the app work. And now that you can upload anything, it's like nobody needs to use the app to film. So I missed that because it was a leg up that I had, and it was also a fun creative challenge. I liked not being able to use After Effects and editing software. I liked having to figure out how I was going to work within the confines of this little box. But you know what? I think the good thing for people like, especially people like me that started off early, was having gone through that and kind of cut my teeth with the early confines of the app, is that it gave me an aesthetic and a way of thinking that even now that I use really high quality filming equipment and I edit my stuff, I'm still thinking like someone who's trying to be scrappy and original and do something different. So had I not had to pass through that, I would just be another content creator. Whereas now I think I definitely approach content as someone who's like, all right, the focus is not on the technology. It's not on the camera I have. The focus is on like, what is this quirky little attention grabbing story I can do that'll be funny and original. And so I think that original kind of theme or mood that we found in Vine when it first came out is still very much a part of what makes good Vines good.
Yeah. And you've effectively through the reps, it does come down to the amount of videos you produce, but there is nothing that replaces it doesn't matter what tool you're using, the mind muscle of creating a 6-second video is your competitive advantage. Because anyone can just go into, you know, After Effects and create a 6-second video and upload it, but have they done it in a manner that tells that story in six seconds? Because right. You've created all those videos, you've got that.
The other thing that's a huge benefit to that 6-second format is that, for example, I think this season with Scott for the Vikings, for the Vine Kings, the first video I did was something I made out of a piece of chalkboard and paper cutouts. I've done one with Legos. I made a clay stop motion figure. This last week's one was, I don't know if you know the TV show Archer on Fox, but I made something that kind of looked like Archer, where it was a cartoon. I did one on post-it notes that were all hand-drawn. So thus far, every video that I've made for the Vikings has been a pretty radically different style. They've all been somehow animated, but they've all been pretty different. And I think that that's something too, that one, it's great that Scott and the Vikings are fine with being like, all right, let's just do all sorts of different stuff. It doesn't have to be every week these, you know, three key colors from our logo, this branding and this blah, blah, blah. It's like, we can do something different, iterate, see what works and also keep it fresh. The other benefit is that since it's only 6 seconds, you can change it up like that. If we were producing 30-second videos every week, we'd have to find one style that we knew we could knock out that was repeatable and kind of mass producible. And so when you're only dealing with 6 seconds, it's like, you know what? Heck, this week, let's do something that's just totally different. And 6 seconds is short enough that you can tell a story, but also get away with doing something that, you know, reinventing the wheel, which that may not work for everybody. It's certainly not what a lot of traditional marketers want to see, where they're like, we need to reinforce the brand. But I think we're in a new world where people like to be surprised. Sometimes it's good to see something different. And so I think that short 6-second, as with 140 characters on Twitter, it brings out a spontaneity and a freshness and a freedom to production that is great.
What are your thoughts on, you know, you've done a lot of work in the US, and as you said, you sort of flow between France and the US with your work with Euro 2016. What's the take up and the reaction to Vine outside of the US in Europe and other parts of the world? Is there any other part of the world that's really diving in and finding the platform engaging? And how are the Euro 2016 Vines accepted?
They did. I mean, you know, I don't follow everything that happens with European soccer, so I'm not sure compared to everything else how they went. From my point of view, it was awesome. The response was awesome. I think one of the vines I did, I tweeted out and then I was actually revined by the Euro Cup. And that was huge, like just the amount of response. So, and they seemed like they were genuinely very, very happy with the response and the content. So I think in France and Germany, I think just in general, social's a different game just because culturally there's a different approach to social media for numerous reasons. And that's changing. But I think in general, it's a little bit slower. You do have other cultures like Brazil. I was going to do some stuff through Twitter for the Olympics. And I now have two kids and there's a lot going on. So that didn't work out and for the best probably, but Brazil is one of those countries where, and a lot of South America, where social Vine, Twitter, everything is just, it's insane the amount of just like engagement you get and the amount of voices on there. Same for Japan. Japan has a lot of activity. Indonesia, there's huge communities on social media in Indonesia.
And is it because so
there are parts around the world.
They're really mobile, those countries in particular, really mobile first. Like that, I mean, there is that talk of that the mobile screen is the first screen, but in some of those countries it really is. It's like their first and their second screen.
Yeah, there's the mobile issue. There's also, again, like with Europe, there's just cultural issues where I think that the way people act socially and how they interact, how they talk to each other really affects how people then transmit that or behave on social media. But mobile is a huge issue. The kind of way that people engage with brands really changes culturally. So there's a lot of factors, but you do see certain hotspots where people just, God, if you put like a certain player in a video or if you talk about a certain match, like it just, the metrics are insane because people are just, you know, like a feeding frenzy of engagement. So it's funny. It's always great to produce content like that because you know that people are going to love it no matter what. So.
Very good. Well, I'm going to finish off with the Sports Geek closing five. Do you? I know you did say you weren't a sports fan, but do you remember the first sports event that you ever attended?
No, I do. Even though I'm not a sports fan, I was born in the early 80s. And so for my 9th birthday, I grew up near Sacramento. And the Sacramento Kings, when I was a kid, were probably the worst team in the world. But Michael Jordan and the Bulls came and played the Kings. And so for my 9th birthday, my aunt got me a ticket. And what was great was because the Kings were so bad and because Jordan was at the peak of his game, it was literally like, it was like when the Globetrotters play your local fire department. It was really just him against no one. So I remember for my 9th birthday going and seeing Michael Jordan just destroy. And that was like the coolest sporting event ever. And that was the first one I ever went to. So maybe that's why I'm not a sports guy now. I peaked too early.
Oh, that is a high bar to set. So yeah, it's like, why would you go back to basketball after seeing Michael Jordan? What would be your favorite food at a sporting event? There's plenty of options these days.
I hope I'm allowed to say this, but definitely my favorite food at a sporting event would have to be a giant beer. I don't know that I actually eat much when I go to games, but getting a nice cold beer and watching a game, there's not a lot that's better than that.
You won't get a complaint from
creativity.
You won't get a complaint from me. There's nothing better than a beer at a sports event. what is the first app that you open in the morning?
Right now, it's definitely Twitter. I've tried to like actually go on a detox because it's to the point of addiction. But with the elections, with personal news, with just world news, especially I'm a huge fan of, it's not for everyone, but the Moments tab that's on the Twitter app now, having essentially my own newspaper every morning when I open up my feed to see what's going on, like that's how I start my day. So Twitter by far.
Have you on that? I know I agree the from the news point of view. Have you tried Nuzzle?
No, I haven't.
So Nuzzle is a tool. Yeah, you should. It's an app. I think it's something that Twitter should acquire. It's an app that effectively pulls in all the news from your Twitter friends that are engaging with the most and tweeting the most. So if your friends are tweeting about a specific particular article, that will float up to the top of the Nuzzle app, and you can also get an email. So I get the email every day, and you know it'll send me five articles, and I'm like, yeah, I really should read all of them, and I know that 10 or 20 or 30 people of my friends have tweeted or liked it. So It's really good in that curation space.
I have to check it out. Sounds good. Nuzzle.
Nuzzle, yeah. Nuzzel. Is there someone, again, this is a, I think this is a good question because it sort of hopefully puts people outside the comfort zone in the world of sports. Is there anyone that you suggest that the podcast listeners should follow and why they should give them a follow, whether it be someone on Vine or Twitter?
You know, I have a hard time with this because this is how I'm going to dodge this question is that 2 years ago when right after I kind of started or ended the first season with the 49ers, we lost our home in a huge fire. There's been all these fires in San Francisco and the building we were living in was one of the buildings that was hit. So we lost our home, we lost everything. And then just until a month ago, we've essentially been nomads for about 2 years. We did a big trip around North America. We lived in France. My wife's French. We stayed with her family for a while. But as a result of this, I am right now so totally out of touch with what's hip and cool that I'm kind of just right now taking baby steps. So if you have a recommendation for me, I'll take it. But I'm like totally out of the loop. I like really need to get back on the page of what's cool and hip right now because I got nothing.
That's fine. You can take a break. So what, outside of digital then, what have you been getting, if anything, you know, your inspiration from your you know, feeding that content part of your brain? Has it been in book form? Has it been in podcast form? Or is it just been the taking in the world?
You know, a part of it is, so we have a 2-year-old daughter and we have a 6-month-old son. And so that right now, I think part of the benefit of having been thrown off our kind of status quo of the lives that we had with the fire, part of the benefit was that it forced us to take a kind of a digital detox where, yes, I still check Twitter in the morning, but we didn't have the same routines. And so for the past 2 years, there was a period this summer where I felt bad for Scott trying to contact me about the Viking stuff because it was literally like trying to send me notes by carrier pigeon. But, you know, I think as a digital producer, as someone who was at Twitter for a number of years, who was kind of like a, you know, for a brief moment in time, like a D-list celebrity on the internet, I had my moment of fame with that. And then the amount of content that I produce for brands, I think something that's really important as with any well-balanced diet is tuning out for a while. So I think for the past, especially year, a lot of the content I create has benefited from the fact that I've really kind of cut myself off from a lot of digital stuff. Unfortunately, I'm getting back into it now and becoming an addict again. But I think a lot of my inspiration has just come from seeing my kids and just kind of getting off the internet for a while so that I can kind of digest and think about all the information that we're hit with every day. So
I think it's really important from a creative point of view because you can be, you know, the brain can be overloaded with so much information. There's not enough space for you to actually have that, you know, that creative space to breathe and figure things out.
There's that. And the other side of it too is I think a huge problem with someone like me who's creating content and someone like, you know, anyone who's at a team who's creating content is it becomes so insularly competitive that you spend all your time looking at what other teams are doing, what other people, like for me, what other Viners are doing, that instead of thinking, you know, what do I want to do today? You're like, oh, I saw what they did. How can I do something better? Or, oh, why didn't I think of that? Or I've now got to do something else. Like you're no longer, I think the best content is content you produce because you're producing content because you have something to say, you're something that's inspired me or something you got to get off your chest. That's where you do good work. And the problem with the internet is we're just so inundated with stuff that we're trying to outdo or get more likes than, or, you know, go more viral than, that we forget about why we should be creating content. It becomes a rat race. So I think as a content producer, there's a benefit to kind of being cut off and not really knowing. I mean, occasionally I'll produce something and I'll get an email from a friend who's like, dude, someone else just did this and it's embarrassing, but I'd rather accidentally do something that someone else has done than just waste so much time trying to think of how I can beat someone else. Cause it's not about beating someone. It's about doing your thing. And so
I reckon that
not knowing is kind of good.
I think that is good advice. You know, you said there before the rat race, there is a bit of a tendency to be on that wheel. To be on that wheel and just have to keep that wheel and that velocity of that wheel going, like the mouse in the little wheel. Sometimes you've got to get off that wheel and think about things. I think I know the answer to this, but what is your social media MVP?
I still, I mean, I try to be objective, but I still think that Twitter offers something that just no other platform is doing. Snapchat can be really fun. Instagram is beautiful and you can have great content. Facebook is nice for seeing, I mean, not to be cliche, but it's nice for seeing pictures of my nephews and nieces. But Twitter is the only platform where I feel I'm consistently given a huge gamut of points of view. I'm given real-time information. I have access to palatable news events that don't just fall into this. Like on Facebook, it's always the same sort of stuff. So for me, Twitter is just, it's funny to see them as a company with their stock price hitting so many road bumps and having so many problems, because I think the value of what Twitter offers culturally to all of us is so tantamount, so important that it's amazing that it's not worth $1 billion. But Twitter, I think, is, if it ever figures out how to market itself properly and people understand how to use it right, I think Twitter still is just the most crucial social media platform, or just media platform out there.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, just on if Twitter knows how to market both itself and its own content in its own platform, then I think that's sort of the secret sauce that they haven't figured out. Like, you know, the Thursday Night Football is on, you know, and they're moving to more to be a media player than a social media platform. I still feel like they don't quite know how to best promote, make sure everyone sees that content, what the experience is like. They're still trying to figure that piece out. What are your thoughts?
You know, Sean, I have to say it's all my fault. I was on the marketing team and I have to do my fine things. It's literally all of this conversation. It should have been me doing that, and I left. And
I won't put all the blame on you, because I think it's, you know, much as it's more the experience. I mean, I was at the Twitter offices in 2012, getting a bit of a tour, and I walked past one of the rooms, and they were obviously working on onboarding new users. And I said to Laura, who was giving me the tour, I said, "Oh, great! It'll be terrific when Twitter fixed that for a new person." And I still feel that they really haven't. They haven't fixed that whole, "Hey, you're new to Twitter. What is it? How do you use it?" Because it's sort of like you either get Twitter, and normally, you know, you might have signed up really early, like you and I, and we know what Twitter is for us, and we use it and love it and get our news from it. But then if someone, you know, you don't realize how daunting potentially it is to be new to Twitter and what it is and not know all the pieces.
No hyperbole, but I think I made 3 videos that were part of the new user sign-up flow, like full-on videos, beautifully animated and everything, explaining what Twitter, like the videos were called, like the file name was what_is_twitter.mov. I made 3 videos that were part of the sign-up flow that we beta tested, and we did all this stuff, and it was a huge problem. We tried doing that forever, and every time there was some reason, like part of the platform would change, or there'd be a focus on a new feature, and it would get scrapped, but the amount of just hours I spent trying to answer that question. And I mean, that was part of why I loved Vine when it came out, was because it was like, you don't spend 3 months making a video that never gets published. You could just do a 6-second video. But yeah, trying to help new users get that is just such an Achilles heel for the brand.
Well, hopefully, you know, all this posturing around purchases and stuff like that help rocket it forward, or someone else comes in to fix it. But it does remain to be seen where it ends up. Before we finish up, where can people find you, see your work, learn more about what you're doing?
Well, one of the easiest ways is, I think there's one other guy in the world named Ian Padgham, and he lives in Australia, and he does donkey tour guides. So if you Google Ian Padgham, chances are you're going to find me. Otherwise,
I know the Australian Ian Padgham.
What?
I know the Australian Ian Padgham. I used to work with him many years ago.
Shut up.
Yeah, I do.
No way.
Yeah. So I've got 2 Ian Padghams in my contact address, in my contacts, and you're one of them. So yeah, it is not a common name. So if you find it, if you Google Ian, you'll be the Ian that they find, because I don't think Ian is that active online. But yeah, it is crazy that I do know the other Ian Padgham.
I've always liked, if I ever go to Australia, I gotta find this guy. But that's so cool. Wow, he just blew my mind.
So, yeah, you can find you via your website, Origiful.
Origiful, yeah.
Yeah, Origiful, O R IGIFUL.com. And if you go to that Vine, you'll see all the different vines you've produced. I'll put a few of them in the show notes. And thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much. It's been great talking, and hopefully we'll have some great content from the Vikings for the rest of the season here.
Definitely.
Sign up for Sports Geek News at sportsgeekhq.com/signup now.
Thanks again to Ian Padgham, a.k.a. Origiful. It took me about 8 goes to start getting that right. Origiful, O-R-I-G-I-F-U-L. Question for the podcast. How are you keeping your brand fresh? Ian talked about providing this new content outside the scope of the world of sports, not looking at the world of sports for inspiration. How are you providing content that does stop the thumbs? I'd love to hear what your suggestions are. Please either send me a tweet or share them in the Sports Biz Slack community. Really enjoying the conversations having in there. Current total of people in there, 527 sports biz executives around the world. We've got a jobs channel where you can post different jobs if you're looking for a job. And then the conversation. I have to share, and I did share this on the Sports Geek Facebook page. This was a post of the week that came through. Thank you to Scott Goodacre from the Online Rule for posting this in the Sports Biz Slack from Burton Albion FC, announcing their starting 11 with yellow, with white writing. The eyes. Your eyes literally bleed when you see this post. Was it a graphic malfunction, or was it done deliberately to get a lot of shares of people mocking it? I think it's a little bit of more so the latter than the former, but I do wonder what the long-term, I guess, bump. Are people going to follow Burton Albion FC ongoing, or are they just going to mock and point out the one post? So it's good to do those stunts, but think about what is the longer-term point and purpose of why you're going through it. Before I wrap up, one more thing. I've done this once or twice before over the years. I'm opening up the Sports Geek Intern Program. I've got a project that's coming up that needs a bit of assistance. So if you are wanting to break into the world of sports, are listening to the podcast, that is almost the first qualifier. The fact that I'm launching this link only on the podcast. If you go to sportsgeekhq.com/intern, one, you'll sign up. And what I will do over the next 5 days is train you up on how I go about doing a lot of the things in Sports Geek, as well as make you jump through a few hoops to see that you can use the tools. Because as Ian said in the conversation, you've got to be able to create the content and use the tools to be able to do it then on subsequent accounts, whether it's running a team account or producing great content for a brand. So if you're interested, if you're passionate to learn how to make digital work for business outcomes in the sports scene, if you're an avid listener to podcasts, I really do need someone that does listen to podcasts and understands the podcasting landscape a little bit. Can you write? Can you string together a sentence? Can you put together a blog? Can you review things? And if you want to break into the sports industry, one thing I can guarantee is I will set up some introductions and you'll meet some people. And if you're really smart, you're already in the Sports Biz Slack community. So go to sportsgeekhq.com/intern, fill out your details, follow the steps, follow the prompts. And I'm really looking forward to helping a few young up and kind of sports biz people get their first start and make their first steps in their career, as well as help me on this new project. Until next episode, stay tuned for the end of the episode for the sounds of the game. Thank you very much to Dave McKay, former guest of the podcast from SPP. He was lucky enough to do his own Sports Geek trip over in Europe, and he caught Man United and captured the intros at Old Trafford. So that's what you'll hear at the end of the podcast. But until then, my name is Sean Callanan, and you've been listening to the Sports Geek Podcast.
Like the Sports Geek Podcast? Find us on Facebook.com/SportsGeek. Check out which teams work with Sports Geek at SportsGeekHQ.com/clients. Please leave a review on iTunes. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/iTunes. Thanks for listening to the Sports Geek Podcast.